Hello. We meet again. Welcome to Conversations with Nova Reid. We are absolutely flying through season two, and I am in gratitude for you joining me this season, and I'm loving receiving all of your feedback. So keep it coming. Huge shout out to my small but fierce Patreon community of podcast supporters. I appreciate you. So can you believe it? This season takes us to my book launch in September, and we are just a few weeks away. You can tell I'm counting down, can't you? I cannot wait for you to have it in your hands and to see how you all respond to it. Such a insulated, very isolating and also intimate experience writing a book. You're so close to it for so long. At the time of recording, my book cover was revealed a few days ago. And when the design of your cover is revealed, all of the sort of blurb, shall we call it, that goes on the website of your booksellers, you know, from giants like Waterstones and Amazon to independent bookstores. There's obviously this huge tech network that links everything together. And I was reading it and I was like, I don't do that for work anymore. And I emailed my publishers and I said, we need to change that blur, because a lot of the explanation of what I do and how I do it has really, really changed. But what it highlighted is that when I started this journey of writing the book, it was nearly 4 years ago, and so much has changed since then. And so you're with this content, and of course it evolves and changes as you evolve and change and grow, but you're with this content for such a long time and only a small, intimate group of people get to see it, and then suddenly it being out there in the world for everyone to engage with it, disengage with it, love it, loathe it, lots of feelings bubbling up, but I cannot wait for you to have it. Depending on when you're listening to this, it is available for pre-order now, and the link to it is in the show notes, or I will leave it in the show notes. And if you're listening to this after the effect, you can get it from your favourite bookseller. But yeah, The Good Ally will be out in a few weeks' time in September. So we are cracking on with a interview with founder of Black Minds Matter. I managed to pin her down, busy woman, Agnes Makachuma, today. And it is wonderful to get an insight into what it's like to run a charity, but to also have had such enormous growth and success and be in your 20s. I kid you not. What Agnes has achieved and is achieving in her 20s is something that I can never imagine being even remotely able to do when I was fresh and young. But we're talking about all that goes into running, being an entrepreneur, all that goes into being human. We're talking about burnout and how it can be a bit of a nemesis for us and people doing any kind of social justice work, where our work is so closely linked to being of service, how sometimes that can blur the line and pose a real risk to our own well-being. We're also talking about the fact that really Black Minds Matter was birthed out of a huge, huge gap in need within our own mental health services within the NHS. And we're talking about the impact on people's lives that Black Minds Matter is having, and also the impact that Black Minds Matter is also having on Black therapists' lives. None of this is a surprise to me because it's my world, and some of the stories that we speak about are similar to those I share in the book. But just hearing about how some therapists, you know, Black therapists are in a minority in the UK, and some of what they have to do to navigate that landscape as being Black and being in an institution that really, like most things, is well and truly rooted in medical racism, from not feeling valued to not being picked as therapists because of the color of their skin, right through to not having their qualifications and their credibility trusted, and how that's all just completely turned on its head, and being able to be valued and be of service without any of that nonsense on top. So we really do dive in. And we also talk about Black Minds Matter 21K Challenge. Black Minds Matter was birthed out of last summer and the murder of Def Floyd, and this sort of spotlight been shone on Black lives, and also so much collective, personal and historical trauma being triggered in this, you know, as I mentioned before, this huge gap in service provision. What it also highlighted is the appetite around that time, and I can attest to this, of people giving one-off donations, and the apathy that has followed. And so what that has birthed is lots of people giving one-off donations. And of course, as we explore in this episode with Black Minds Matter, that doesn't go very far when it comes to therapy and people needing ongoing support. So I'm also want to raise attention to their 21K challenge, which I will be linking in the show notes, to encourage people to consider donating regularly, from as little as £5 a month, and how far that can go to continuing to help. Because as you and I both know, racism doesn't go away in 12 months. This is cultural, and it will be here for as long as people continue to be apathetic. And I may even be talking to you. So, let's have a listen. And as ever, I can't wait to hear what you think. Hop on over to Instagram, Nova Reed Official, to let me know. And without further ado, over to the episode. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I am delighted to be joined by founder of Black Minds Matter, Agnes Mwakachuma. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Nova. This is such an honour, and I'm so excited for this conversation.
Me too. A real treat. So firstly, I just want to start by asking you, how are you?
I'm happy but exhausted. Mm. As in, you know when, well, basically I moved from my mum's place where I was quarantining. I'm now based in London. And that move was just everything I needed in terms of inspiration, being closer to friends. My friends live about 10 minutes away from me, which is such a huge change from having to get a 2-hour train. Wow. So I feel lighter and I feel excited for what my mind gets to do with all this time, space and creativity. But I'm also just exhausted from the move, and also running BMM has just been insane. We're down to our final 500 clients. So wow. It's been a interesting 2 months.
Yeah, huge. I mean, moving is full of all of the stuff at the best of times, let alone whilst you're an entrepreneur and the work that you do. So I hear you, and thank you for sharing honestly about that. So Agnes, play along with me. Who are you beyond your roles?
I am an extrovert. Like, I love being around people. As much as I do value my own space and my own company, I thrive getting to know people. I thrive in outside spaces. So I love electronic music. I love traveling. I love Tanzania. I have a great passion for African languages. I am not what a lot of people expect, because I'm just like a walking contradiction of everything. But I am just what I'd like to think, daring.
Mm. Nice.
But exciting at the same time, I hope.
Thank you. Nice. So if it feels good for you to share, where did you grow up and what was that like? And when did you realise you were Black?
I was born in Tanzania. And then 6 months after my mother had me, we moved to Botswana in Southern Africa. We lived there for about 13 years. And then my parents, I think, took a break. My mum then moved to Devon in Torquay, very random. Now looking back, it makes sense. It was probably the safest thing for her at the time. But yeah, that's when I finally realised that this skin color that I have is a big deal.
Yeah. Huge culture shock as well.
Huge culture shock. I was the first black girl in school.
Yeah.
So constantly having that reminder and having to answer questions every day felt like doing a podcast interview, genuinely, because every day you met someone that was just fascinated. So that was when I realized, okay, yes, I am a black woman and I'm so different to everyone around me. I never thought it would be a big deal. You grow up watching shows and you just never, during that time, we never saw how black people were being treated, especially in countries in the West.
Mm. Do you remember how that made you feel, that curiosity around what was in a white majority space and otherness, how that made you feel?
I think that really knocked my self-esteem a lot.
Yeah.
And from the moment I first started school to, I'd say, about 2019, I was in a cycle of constant performing.
Mm.
It was like every day was an act of constantly trying to conform to the masses, just so every day meant I had to answer less questions. I had to explain myself less. I had to be understood more. It was draining looking back, but at the time as a child, all I just wanted to do was make friends.
Yeah.
That was my priority, and I was going to do that at any cost necessary. I remember I used to go back home because I used to have an American accent. If a lot of people have grown up in Africa, you will know the American accent that we adopt from watching way too many American shows. I used to have that accent, and I'd go, and like when I was in school, people would like take the piss. I'd say something and they'd repeat it to me, and then they'd laugh about my pronunciation. This is why I always say, like, laughing at some, how people pronounce words is actually quite jarring and quite hurtful. And I'd go back home and I would practice over and over again how certain British words were said.
Yeah.
Just because I didn't want that to happen again, and I didn't want anyone to laugh at me. And I know a lot of people who have ever had their pronunciations or like their accents taking the mickey of will know what that feels like. And to the person doing it, it's just a bit of a laugh. Like, you know, you say potato, I say potato and stuff like that. But to the person who is trying their best already to not be seen, to then be called out in a class of children laughing at the way you pronounce the word, it's just like you just kind of sign up to a lifetime of consistently trying to not let that happen again. So this went from accents to then clothing to then hair to then the people I used to hang around with to the shows I used to watch, the music I used to listen to, because I wanted to know what the music was. I remember like going to a party when we were about 13, it was like some kid's birthday party and they were singing, I think it was Kings of Leon at the time, and me not knowing a single word and thinking, I need to go back home and I need to learn all these songs. So it's just a constant, not only was I in school, but I was also schooling myself at home all the time and schooling myself on the wrong things. Like I should have been in school, you know, leaving school and finding my own passions and reading and studying, but instead I was mimicking accents, learning how to do my hair and learning how to straighten my hair. Just learning very pointless things that a 13-year-old should not be wasting time doing.
And also learning quickly how assimilation is a method of survival, and also in the process being everything but yourself. But of course you don't know that then, because all you want to do is fit in. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I think I lost myself for years.
Yeah.
Completely. I lost myself for years. And I always look back and I think, who were you? Like, who were you? Who are you trying to be? And it's only now, like, I've had the same friends for 10 years since like college. And now is they're finally getting to know me. And it's such a shock. Like, I was speaking to my friend the other day and we were having this really deep conversation. And she was like, I never knew that about you.
Mm.
And I was like, I considered you my best friend for 10 years. I can't believe you never knew that. But it's because I was way too busy whenever we were together, just performing. So she never really got to really know me. And it's only in the last 2 years that I feel like I've really grown insanely close to my friends because of my willingness to be vulnerable, my willingness to be myself. But it's also very saddening to think all those, you know, the last 10 to 15 years have just been me in a shell of my own body, trying to be someone I'm not.
Yeah. Your story, I know, for those listening, will resonate with so many of us, in particularly in black and brown bodies, not exclusively, but it will resonate with so many who are listening. So often we do that. We think that's the magic component to belonging.
Oh my gosh. Exactly. And even the idea that, like, when I look at how much time I used to spend even just doing my hair or my makeup or putting on maybe like an accent at the time, I look back and I think, you could have just been yourself and they would have loved you regardless.
Yeah.
But that fear of being rejected, that fear of not belonging to a community, and a lot of the times we underestimate how important feeling seen is. Mm-hmm. When I went to university, I lived with a mixed group of girls. And the second year, I finally found this flat in a house with, I think it was four other girls from London. They were all Jamaican. And they have never met anyone like me, like as in a black girl who had never been around black people, who just had like a very different life, different accent. And I found it so hard to even fit in. We did eventually. We ended up getting along very well because that, for me, that was the first time that I felt like I didn't have to hide what I was having for dinner. I didn't have to hide the kind of music I liked.
Yeah.
I didn't have to hide myself. But also for them, they would never have understood the pressure that I was under to perform my whole life, because they were always surrounded by people that got them and people they never had to explain themselves to. So even dating for them was so different. Like at the time I was dating somebody who was white. The other girls all had black boyfriends. They just never got it. And it was very interesting, actually. It was one of the most eye-opening experiences that I'd ever had, because that was the first time since moving to England that I'd ever lived or been around other black people.
Oh, of course, because of where you were located when you moved to England.
Yeah, there was no one in my town that was black. Maybe like one person, but she's probably an older lady. So that was very interesting and so eye-opening. And that's kind of when I think I felt like there was more outside there for me, and that I didn't have to stay in that constant state of performing, and that the world is big enough for me to go out there and kind of unlearn the things that I believe to be true and truly find myself again.
Lovely. Thank you. It's lovely to hear more about your journey, so I appreciate you sharing that with me. So tell me more about how Black Minds Matter came about.
Yes, so Black Minds Matter came about. Firstly, my first ever kind of relationship with therapy was when I lost my older brother.
How old were you?
I was about 18 at the time. And obviously coming from an African household, that wasn't a priority. No one really cared about, you know, getting the kids counselling, because it was a very traumatic thing. No one really cared about that. And they were more concerned about, I don't know, just other things that weren't even important. So I started to notice a massive dip in my emotions. This is the first time I'd ever felt, although I'd felt alone numerous times, this was the first time I'd ever felt like I was in a hole that I couldn't get out of.
Yeah.
And it felt like a never-ending cycle of denial, because it took me a very long time to accept my brother's death. And it also just felt like I knew I needed help. I knew something wasn't right. So I went to the NHS, tried to seek out mental health support from them, and I was allocated a therapist, and she had no clue where Tanzania even was on the map.
Oh.
So a lot of our sessions were surrounding me, kind of her acting culturally shocked about things, and then me kind of having to explain myself again about things that didn't really matter in the session.
Yes.
So then an hour would go by and I just didn't feel like I'd been awarded that space to really understand my grieving emotions.
Yeah.
So then I decided to get a job, a second job, so that I could pay for therapy. And I found an amazing lady in Bristol. And we had like Skype sessions actually at the time before Zoom. And it just changed a lot for me because she got it. She understood my mom and my family's early stages of denial, the whole situation. Coming from an African household, a lot of the time when deaths are very sudden and cannot be explained, a lot of people's first reactions are assuming that there's some black magic involved.
Yeah.
So my mum went, my family, we went through all of these emotions of just constant denial. And so not having to explain that to my therapist, because she got it, she understood how that was a reality for me. Whereas my white therapist at the time, she just didn't get it. Like, she didn't understand why we would think it was witchcraft.
Yeah. And then you have to spend a whole part of the session trying to explain the backdrop to that, which is, of course, is irrelevant, but you need her to know it in order for her to do her job properly.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
So I went through that, went through therapy. That was life-changing. And
so
then...
at the moment, how did you find your Bristol therapist?
Google.
Yeah.
It wasn't like overnight, honestly.
It was
back in the day when Google was not that effective. Well, it feels like back in the day. So I was scrolling, and a lot of black therapists don't put their profile pictures online.
They don't.
Because the chances of them even getting bookings are very slim. When you look at unemployment rates in the UK, black people are nearly four times more likely to be unemployed. So the chances of black people seeking paid therapy privately are very slim. So we have more white people seeking therapy, and a lot of the time, a lot of people try and say it's because of the stigma of mental health in our community, and I'm trying to walk away from that idea. I feel like we've been failed numerous times by the healthcare system, but we also just don't have that disposable income like white people do. Anyway, so looking back at the Black Lives Matter movement last year, I noticed a lot of friends around me and people online were showing very concerning signs of depression, of kind of re-experiencing traumas.
Mm-hmm.
And the different conversations that were happening were fueled by anger, because we were then having to have arguments with people online who just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more frustrating, nothing more time-wasting than explaining racism to somebody that is so committed to not seeing colour.
Yeah. Yep.
It's so draining. And so I saw that, and I had a chat with my fellow founder, Annie. And we were like, I was just like, I think people need money to go to therapy, because I can only imagine how many people are feeling so triggered by this.
Mm.
So we decided to start a GoFundMe page. And at the time we were like, oh, should we just, like, I don't know, try and raise £10,000 to help a few people go to therapy? And so I spent that night creating a website. We launched the GoFundMe page, and within 24 hours, we'd reached, I think, £50,000.
Wow.
And not just that, but we had, in the first week, 1,000 requests for therapy.
Yeah.
From the black community. So that's when, you know, it just kind of dawned on me that this is going to be a forever thing. Not forever, because I don't want us to be in this predicament forever, but it's going to be a lot bigger than just raising money and giving it to people.
Yes.
Firstly, we need to ensure that these people are getting adequate support.
Mm.
So we can't just give them the money. We need to ensure that we are connecting them with therapists as well. So we started looking for therapists And my goodness, what a journey. Like, looking back now, I'm like, wow. We had sleepless nights searching for these therapists. And we eventually, like, whenever we found one therapist, they introduced us to, like, another two.
Right.
Before you know it, we had, at the time, it was only, I think, about 20. And it felt incredible. It was, like, enough to feel comfortable. But I never knew that in the UK, there's only, like, less than 1,000 therapists in comparison to nearly 21,000 therapists in total.
Less than 1,000 black therapists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's kind of how it came about. And then we slowly started learning more about the world of mental health and what that is like for black people trying to seek out therapy and the difficulties that, you know, arise in the world of mental health for a black person, whether that's over medication, sometimes even under medication, not being taken seriously, being detained under the Mental Health Act.
Yeah.
There were just so many issues that we were coming up against, and it just became a lifelong mission to kind of improve the accessibility of mental health services, especially for black people in the UK. And we've had such an incredible year. Like, looking back now, talking about that, I still can't believe it. We've given access to over 1,500 people.
Amazing.
Sessions. And we are now coming up to our final group of 500 from our wait list.
Great.
So that it's amazing.
That's great.
And we work with nearly 200 therapists now.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you, how that number changed. So, yeah. Incredible. And everything that you say, like, you know, being sectioned under the Mental Health Act, not being taken seriously, and all of these things are disproportionate to what people who are white and different to what people in other marginalized communities experience.
Exactly.
So there are so many reasons why I am not surprised you have so many people who are using your service, are benefiting from your service, because of living in a system that systemically discriminates, and you're compounded by that mentally, of course.
nobody
takes into consideration, okay, what is the impact of social suffering?
Exactly.
Of continuing to deal with this gaslighting or not being believed or disproportionately sectioned and not offered, you know, community support or therapeutic support. What's the impact of that? So
a lot of people forget how kind of systemic racism pours into various areas of our society, whether that's the police system. When you look at London, for example, last year, black men were stopped and searched over 21,000 times.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what that can do to somebody?
That wasn't even for the whole year. That was for, May and it was the period of lockdown treatment.
It was basically the summer.
Yeah.
And then when you look at poverty rates, when you look at the housing system and the education system and how black kids from a very young age, how we are disciplined in school. I, for example, can always remember whenever we used to play netball, I used to get harsher punishments than the other girls. Whenever we were in school, somebody could stand up and tell the teacher to F off in a class. But lo and behold, I'm sat having a chit chat with someone next to me. The punishments were very different.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what that's like for children who are so young that they just can't be that easily, not disciplined, but like that easily aware of things going on around them and not having to understand why you get detained. You get to stay behind for detention, whereas your other friends get away easily.
So
it starts from a very young age, and then the amount of hurdles that you have to experience in the healthcare system constantly, and then the education system, and then the housing system, it becomes too much. You get to the age of 25 and you are very close to just kind of giving up on the system as a whole.
Of course, because why would you, like, cognitively, why would you want to continue to cooperate or buy into a system that's not serving you and is not made to serve you?
Exactly.
So, of course, these things make so much sense to me. So it was really birthed out of, you know, the rise in the BLM resurgence and seeing this appetite well, not even just an appetite. So you've got on one side, you've got this appetite for anti-racism. So many people who are in white or other ethnic groups suddenly realizing, oh, okay, I need to wake up. And then on the other side, this collective communal trauma and this gap in the middle about, okay, where do we go to get the help that we need?
Yeah, exactly. And also lockdown.
Yeah.
Lockdown has been incredibly difficult. When we look at the figures when it comes to COVID, the fact that Black people were 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with COVID, even just hearing those figures alone is enough to worry anyone. Mm. So it's been a very difficult period, especially for Black people in the UK. We've had to kind of relive a lot of things that we just weren't quite prepared to do, especially in a pandemic, being cut away from our communities due to all these social distancing rules, which are rightfully so, because we are there's a deadly virus out there. But then having to, when you look at how we live as a community, we're just not used to that idea of separation in terms of being separated from your family and social gatherings. So it's been difficult, but it's also just been interesting to see how the therapists themselves have reacted to to BMM in general. And for them being able to work with clients who they feel truly understand them and value their qualifications and value them as a person has been life-changing. And also when you look at the gap when it comes to earnings for their Black therapists and white therapists, it's very clear that there's a huge problem.
Yeah, there's inequity there as well.
Yes, definitely.
And undermining by the sounds of what you're saying.
It is. And I actually often ask my white friends, like, would you ever have a Black therapist? And usually, honestly, they are like, you know, it wouldn't be my first choice, not because I don't trust them, but just there's clearly something deeper going on in the fact that we don't trust Black professionals as much as we would a white professional.
To me, it makes. I'm not saying it's right, but it makes sense because for so long, Black people have been placed in positions of inferiority, so they're not used to seeing Black people in leading roles, senior roles, and that feeds into decision-making and behaviour. I had a colleague of mine share who does more coaching than therapy, and they provide wellbeing services to an organisation. And they were one of two Black people, I think, and nobody was booking them. And like you say, they have their images, so you could select who you wanted to work with. And there was no other defining factor as to why they weren't getting booked and the other therapists were being oversubscribed other than the colour of their skin.
Of course. People don't want to admit it, but that is it.
Yeah.
And it's very sad to know how hard therapists work to become qualified, to then fear even putting your picture up on your online profile, which is supposed to be like your moment of pride.
Yeah.
Because you fear that you're not going to get enough like bookings because of the colour of your skin. Not because you're not great at your job or you're not qualified enough, but just because people have these preconceived sort of attitudes about people that look just like you.
Yeah. And whether or not we are credible. And I mean, I'm not going to get into that. Hoops that I have to jump through to prove my credibility in a number of
I can only imagine.
Yeah, I don't need to say it to you, but I'll save that story for the book. So tell me more, what are some of the things that you're doing at Black Minds Matter this year that we can support with or people can find out about?
Right now, one of our biggest priorities is the 21K Challenge.
Tell me more.
The 21K challenge is basically a challenge where we're trying to get 21,000 lifetime donors donating £5 a month. Only because a lot of, and I've seen this with other organisations, a lot of organisations that were founded during the Black Lives Matter movement last year received a lot of donations. but they weren't ongoing donations. So we're trying to get ongoing support so we can continue to do the work that we're doing, because Black people's problems are not going to disappear in a year. We're not, we don't even have another option for what mental health support will be readily available for Black people if we decide to, you know, close our doors because we don't have enough financial backing. So we're just trying to get as many people donating £5 a month to just keep us afloat. That would mean that we can continue to support and offer support to around 1,500 people a month, a year, and just continue to do the work that we're doing. Because at the moment we're paying out around £100,000 nearly a month in therapy.
But this is it.
And so I'm looking at the figures like, I know we raised £800,000, but that money is running out very fast. And it scares me to ever think that I would have to turn my back on BMM simply because of something as easily solvable as funds. I think that's it. So we're working on that. We're also working on hopefully working alongside a lot of universities. A lot of our clients are in university, so we're trying to do as much as we can to collaborate with universities coming up to offer better wellbeing packages for students. I myself know how difficult and emotionally draining university was, apart from loneliness, isolation, but even just finance. So we're trying to do that more. We're trying to encourage more research into Black mental health. It saddens me that every single time I try and find an answer to something, I'm met with very Eurocentric models of mental health only. So we're trying to collaborate with as many research partners as possible to conduct our own research into that. Get more events, having more events, having more workshops, and really building a more in-person community. All of our community is online, which is great. I still find it weird that I haven't even met some of the team members. So trying to build more of a community online. But our main goal, hopefully by the end of the year, is to open up a fund to support aspiring Black therapists, because becoming a therapist is expensive. And that's why we just don't have enough Black therapists in the UK, because it's a very privileged career to go down. It's not something that you can do at university. So being able to juggle that full time and also pay your bills can be very difficult.
It also is a huge time commitment as well, and a lot of that is, you know, getting your hours in and volunteering. So again, it assumes wealth privilege. It assumes that people have the financial means to be able to do that, and of course disproportionately we don't. So I love that you're taking a holistic approach to serving those who are in need right now, and also looking about the longevity. And actually, we clearly need more Black therapists going through the door, but not operating to fit into this Eurocentric white system, but to develop it in a way that speaks to the needs of for more people than it currently does. So
definitely, really important
work. Thank you, Agnes. So this is another question. This, you've got an enormous enterprise going on there. And you, I believe, my little bit of research I did earlier, you're in your 20s, are you not?
I am.
I just want to...
I'm quite just, you know, a lot of people congratulate me for this, and I'm quite angered, actually, at the fact that I have been sucked into something that I can't let go of because of how personal it is. But also the fact that I'm doing, you know, our famous Prime Minister's job. This is what he should be doing, not me.
There is so much in this that I have to say. So the fact that, again, but it always falls on us to find the solutions to the systems that we're compounded by. We're the ones most compounded by them. So that's a piece. The fact that the NHS Mental Health Service, and I speak about this because I used to work with it and within it for a long period of time, is still so woefully underfunded, and is not serving the people that they need. So there's that piece. And the fact that you have taken it on, whether or not because you feel purpose driven or, well, who else is going to do it?
Yeah.
But it just blows my mind, because so much of, and I'm nearly thinking about if I want to share my age, but I'm nearly entering my fourth decade. And
oh, my God.
I know I've got good genes.
You should be so proud.
Thank you. But I never had, or I certainly never would have believed that I had the resources to be able to do what that you are doing and running a business and something that is so impactful and important in my 20s. So,
yeah, I never thought I would either. Like, I always had a journal of where I'd put, you know, when you have like your reflections of what you kind of want to achieve in life, I always had something similar, maybe in my 50s. And it blows my mind till today that I have done all of this from my phone. I don't use a laptop.
What?
I know. So when people are like, when I'm like, let me just charge my phone, and people are like, why don't you just use your laptop? I'm like, I actually don't have a laptop.
Wow.
So it makes me think of the amount of times that I've kind of tried to convince myself that it was the lack of resources that I couldn't be part of the movement or add value to certain things when I've actually been able to do as much as I can on my phone.
Yeah. I just want to honour that and honour you. And I'm holding in mind that you're in a situation that really you shouldn't be in. I'm holding that in mind as well. But I just want to honour what you are doing and who you are and how you've managed to do that under extraordinary circumstances, and just how exceptional, there is so much exceptional talent within our community, and I just want to honour that and honour you.
Thank you. There is, like, I'm just super proud of Black Brits at the moment. We are shining in ways that I'm sure our forefathers would be insanely proud. Insanely proud. It's incredible how much we've been able to achieve within the last year. But I also feel it's also amazing how we've been able to come together in ways that, you know, ideally we shouldn't have to even be fighting about these things yet. But I'm glad that we haven't given up.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think the important part is that we rest and resource ourselves, because I think it's been role modelled so often that our well-being is not important and shouldn't be prioritised or spoken about. And the only way that we continue to move forward and do well is if we allow ourselves to rest and heal. And or at least
start definitely. That's something I'm learning because it's just been go, go, go. It only hit me a week ago when I was speaking to my therapist, and she said, you've not had a single day off since the 1st of June.
Yeah, that resonates.
And I was like, what? Like, I usually like work and then go and see my friends on a weekend, for example, but I've never had a full day of rest.
Where you're not meeting people.
No.
Yeah.
And so she was like, you need to take time off. And I have been feeling that way. And I think that's why the move from my mum's was great for me, because obviously being based at my mum's, living with my mum and my brother, a lot of the time I didn't have time to run BMM from like communal spaces like the living room or dining room, because everybody else is also using those spaces. So for a whole entire, almost an entire year, I was confined to my four walls.
Yeah.
And not being able to see friends, obviously being in a pandemic, I would wake up, and I kid you not, Nova, and I'm not proud of this, I would wake up, I'd wash my face, brush my teeth, and I would spend the entire day in my robe, in my bed, on my phone, just working until stupid o'clock, 3 a.m. sometimes, 5 a.m., have like 3 hours rest, wake up, meeting. And it's nothing to glamorize. There's nothing nice about that. Because I started to notice my own mental health deteriorating really badly. Yes. And that's quite sad, because that is not, that could have easily been avoided with a bit more structure, a bit more care.
And I think it's there's two things here. It's seductive, and being busy is often celebrated as a badge of honor. Some of us have learned that our worth is aligned with productivity, which is also not true. Some of that is adaptive. Some of that is cultural. Some of that is historical. So I just want to name that. But also for me, working in social justice as well, I'm so purpose driven. Like, my work is for the bigger cause. So I can end up sometimes being a martyr to the cause. Yeah. So I'm naming these things because I think it's important for people to listen that we're not, you know, we're human beings, and it means we are imperfect. And, you know, you learn, don't you? Sometimes my mum has this saying, Jamaican, those who can't hear must feel.
Oh my goodness. That's funny that you said that, because I saw that. I saw someone comment that saying in a picture last night, and I actually wrote it in my notes. I was like, that is so true.
Yeah. Some of us are motivated into change by pleasure, and some of us are motivated into change by pain. So sometimes you have to feel the things before you're like, okay, no more. And then there's a boundary, and then there's learning, and then, you know, there's growth that happens with it. But yeah, I'm glad you have a therapist, and that you've got somebody who can reflect that back to you.
Yeah, she is amazing, and she's so understanding, and she just, like, she is everything I've needed, especially during this journey. I think I would have struggled massively, because majority of my friends just wouldn't understand, and I found it so frustrating. Even like speaking to my mum, for example, she never quite understood what I was doing. You know, like a typical mum, she never got it. So I'd be like, I'm so tired, and she'd be like, you've been on your phone all day.
She just thinks you're scrolling Instagram.
She just thinks I'm scrolling. The charity recently won an award, and it doesn't register in her head. But that's just parents. They never get it. So I found it so frustrating, and constantly having, like, feeling like I was crying out for help all the time, whether that was from friends or family, and them not quite understanding how much work I was doing.
And what you're holding.
It was so frustrating. They just kind of thought like I was, and we were technically managing a whole hospital.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I needed that therapist to validate how I was feeling.
Yeah.
And just to make sense of the fact that, you know, I needed to change my daily habits, because my almost addiction to working on this could have been my very reason for a very long burnout.
Absolutely. Phase. Absolutely. And I'm glad that you were able to recognize that, because sometimes that's just it. It's not to say that we don't have to push sometimes and overextend, but that should be, you know, conscious, not the norm, and every now and then, not the norm. And part of, like, learning how to look after ourselves is that, okay, I'm recognizing the signs of burnout earlier on, before you get to the stage of,
and then having boundaries to actually, like, take notice of those signs.
Yeah, so
sometimes you see things happening, you're like, oh, I'm tired, but I'm not going to listen to myself.
Yeah, you override.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've learned that a lot in the last year, because, you know, you're only as good as how much you look after yourself. You really, like, you could be the smartest person in the room, but if you're not physically in tune, mentally in tune, spiritually in tune with your body, it's just not going to work. I used to have days sometimes where I could see my creativity just kind of disappearing, my zest for life and my zest for, like, what I was doing disappearing, but still being pressured, because you go on social media, you know, someone's released the book, someone's done this, someone's done that, an organization's raised £10 million, like, so many things are going on, and then you're like, I was about to rest, but should I be doing this? Should I be taking a break? Because it's hustle, hustle, hustle all day on social media. But it's about finding what works for you. Like, I have the most odd morning routine, most odd daily routine, but it's what works for me. And, like, I'd never use a laptop, just because I always find working from my phone means that I don't go on social media because I'm doing work. Working from my phone means that when I switch off work, I switch off everything else as well.
It's it's just definitely picking up on what you said about finding your routine. I think that's really important, because you read all these articles about, well, you know, get up at 5 a.m. and do this, and like, I'm never going to be great at 5 a.m. Like, I have, I go in waves. Like, I'm more introverted in the morning, and then towards the afternoon I'm more extroverted. And so it's learning my flow of how I am daily, but then also within the rhythm of my period as well. Like,
exactly,
if I can avoid it, I will not be doing any kind of work where I am giving teachings, public speaking during my period, because it takes so much energy from
me. You don't get taught enough about hormones.
No.
Like, paying attention to your hormones and, you know, it's crucial, because the amount of times that I have almost felt like a failure, or beat myself up about something, or put myself down, had imposter syndrome, when the truth was I was just due in 2 months, in 2 days, sorry. So it's really having that relationship of understanding the power of hormones and learning how to adapt your life around them.
Absolutely.
Because you can't.
There'll be times where, of course, you have less control over that. But generally speaking, when you've got more awareness, it just makes sense. Okay, this is a period of time when I'm more introverted. So let me do all my bloody numbers and admin and all that stuff then. And save the extroverted stuff for when I physically have more energy in my body and my hormones are doing something very different.
Yeah.
So how do you, you know, taking everything into consideration, how do you look after yourself? What works for you?
Oh, what works for me? So my favourite thing, I always look after myself every morning. I don't know, I feel like I have a very protective, like, need to nurture myself in the mornings.
Lovely.
So you'll never catch me running or doing anything strenuous in the mornings. So I usually wake up, and I hate to be that annoying guy, I do wake up at 5. But from 5 o'clock till about 7 o'clock, I'm usually in bed watching my favorite series. I'm obsessed with Showmax. Showmax is like a Netflix in Africa. And I've been watching this thing called The River. It's basically a show in South Africa. I'm obsessed. So 5 o'clock till 7 o'clock is The River. Napping, laying there a little bit confused, like cuddling myself and like just nurturing myself. And that is how I really feel like I look after myself, not rushing into a day. But I also, the best ways that I've learned actually to look after myself over the years is because I'm an extrovert. I find great joy in being around people, but also just being mindful who I'm around. So based on how I'm feeling, I will always ensure I'm around the right people to kind of foster that feeling. So sometimes I might have plans with someone that's super excited, like a friend that likes to maybe party too much, or and the best way to look after myself is to turn that down. Or sometimes I might feel I need that. But I'd love to be like, I'm one of those people that, you know, exercises and does all of that. It's just not for me, because I'm active enough on the weekends. But anyway, I walk a lot. But the best way to look after myself really is just having boundaries with myself, because over the years I've realized I've lost trust for myself, because, like I said earlier in the podcast, I was performing a lot. So I don't trust myself to have my best interests at heart. So the only ways that now I look after myself is just trusting that inner voice more.
Lovely.
And giving my body what it needs every day. And that might be chocolate, and that might sometimes be a nice healthy breakfast.
Lovely. You go with what you feel.
Yeah. And trying to trust that though.
Yeah. And so just two more questions before we finish. This is a question for... Answer it how you would like, either for you, Agnes, as an individual, or for BMM.
Okay.
Who are you becoming?
Accessible.
Ooh.
Both emotionally and with BMM. we're trying to improve the accessibility of mental health services. Me as a person, I'm becoming more accessible emotionally and spiritually.
Lovely. And when you say more accessible for mental health services, can you be specific about what that means?
Yes, definitely. I think we want in the next 2 months to be able to provide a service where people can access a therapist within 72 hours of talking, of emailing us.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I've loved talking with you. And how can people find you and more about BMM and get involved with the 21K Challenge?
Cool. So you could find BMM on Instagram. So that's blackmindsmatter.uk. And the 21K challenge should be, the link should be in our bio. So we would really, really appreciate it if you could spare as much as you can just to support us and trying our best to make mental health services as relevant as possible for Black people in the UK.
Incredible. Thank you for your work, Agnes, and creating space to talk to me today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
So there you have it. In conversation with founder of Black Minds Matter, Agnes Mwakachuma, and giving you an insight into what it's like to run a charity and also provide a service that essentially fills a gigantic shortfall in NHS services. So if you're listening to this and you would like to feel supported by Black Minds Matter, head on over to the charity to find out more about their services and how they may be able to support you. If you are in a position to support Black Minds Matter with their fundraising efforts by donating £5 a month or whatever you can afford as part of their 21K challenge, this will help people continue to access the mental health support that they need and no doubt will be helping a lot of people. So I will, of course, link all of the details in the show notes, so don't worry about writing things down. And that's it. We are storming towards the end of season two. I have, I think another 3 incredible conversations left until we close the season. So don't go anywhere just yet. You know what to do. If this episode resonates with you, please hop on over to your podcast host and leave us a review. Until next time, see you soon.